This is HPR episode 1931 entitled, Atomic Force Microscopy. It is hosted by Amuniz, and is about 26 minutes long. The summary is, general view of the nanoscale tools, special interest with atomic force microscopes AFM.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
This is Andres Munitmiyev at A-P, and I'm here to talk to you a bit of another bit of science. Now I'm going to go into a bit of a nanotechnology, or the more like the instruments used for nanotechnology, and specifically I'd like to delve into a tool called atomic force microscopes. So let me start by, this is basically something that I go over with lots of people, so it hopefully won't sound too rehearsed. So the main problem with small features, by the way, nano is a dimension, nanometers is a dimensional unit, and if you take a meter, divide that by 1,000, you got a micrometer. If you take 100 micrometers, that's about the thickness of a hair. Then 1 micrometer, between 1 and 5 micrometers, that's about the size of a hair, something like that. And then if you keep going down, if you take a micrometer and divide it in 1,000 parts, then you get a nanometer. And nanometers, if you take 0.1 nanometers, that's classical unit called Armstrong that is used as the space between atoms. Organic molecules such as the ones that you can find on your organic light emitting dials on some phones and OLED dials, they can be maybe 100 nanometers in size. So, you know, it's a several atoms bundled up together to make these carbon-based molecules. So, nanometer, the nano world is according to international the ISO standard, I believe is anything that has one of its significant dimensions below 100 nanometer. So, for example, if something called a nanotube is called a nanotube, even though it can be several microns and even millimeters in length, just as long as the diameter of the tube is less than 100 nanometers. And then again, we have things, the new stuff called, for example, graphene or single-layered materials, which is basically one atom thick sheets of stuff. In the case of graphene, it would be carbon. And so, yeah, I think, oh, and then lastly, you know, the original nano stuff was the fluorine ball, which is basically a little ball that is made out of carbon, looks like a football, and it can be less than 100 nanometers in size. So anyway, but that's like a sphere. So anyway, that's defining the scale. Now, the main problem, when I started doing this, sadly, straight out of university, I'd say, yeah, you know, if you want to see something really, really small, you just use clever optics. And, you know, you put the lens one behind each other, and hopefully, you know, at one point you'll start seeing really small stuff. Now, the problem with that is that it seems that the light travels in waves, and anything contained within that wave, which can be 500 nanometers, you don't see. So, you know, there's ways around it. You can basically put several waves together and align them in such a way, and you know they're slightly out of phase, and you'll be able to find out things that are smaller than 300 nanometers or whatever the wavelength of that particular light is. But what's normally the, and I think that's called white light interferometry and whatnot. So anyway, so that's one technique. Another technique you can use is doing something called scanning electron microscopes. So what you do is instead of using light, you basically use electrons, and you flow these electrons through lenses, which are basically kind of like coils that generate a magnetic field and move them on. And since electrons basically tend to move in a straighter line than light, it seems, they hit the surface and they bounce back, and there's like this little detector thing that finds out how much energy that electron bounced back. And that's where you get those like really cool images that you see sometimes on the web of like fleas and mosquitoes that looking like in a grayscale and black and white. That's because color as well loses its definition at that small scale because there's no light. So that's scanning electron microscopy. Another tool that you can use, but the limitation of that is that since you're using electrons, you need to have the sample that you're looking at, you need to be fairly, you know, have some sort of conductivity. So those fleas and little mosquitoes, and you know that you can actually see the little hairs in the mosquitoes, those images, what they actually had to do is that they actually had to coat, you know, first they had to kill the animal, the insect, and second they had to coat it with some sort of carbon-based stuff. So something's called sputter coating, or they cover it with gold, or you know, they basically metallize the insect so that you can actually see it. Now, another thing you can do is that if you something's called transmission electron microscope. So transmission electron microscopes, the way they work. This is very very overview of all the stuff that I'm talking about. It's very overview, but the way I understand it is that you take a material and you cut it really really thin. So you know you have only several atomic layers, you know, maybe you know it can be something like 100 nanometers thick layer, and you put it into this huge microscope, and you basically look at this and you shine electrons through it, and what you look at actually is some sort of projection of your crystal structure of your material. So you basically shine the electrons through, and the electrons go through the material, and depending on how close the electrons get to the atoms or the crystal, more precisely the crystals in the really thin material, they will kind of like change direction slightly. So they will be going in a straight line, and then as they not hit but go through the material, I think maybe it's tunneling through the material, I don't know what the term is, but anyway, as it goes through the material, it slightly deviates and it hits some sort of recorder, which before used to be kind of like a picture, these things that, you know, that expose things, and then you have to go into like a photographic room and expose things and put it through chemistry. But now they have like these really cool, what you'd say, like little cameras, electronic cameras that will detect the electrons. And then there you can actually see the crystal structure of material. But of course, this involves like a huge sample preparation. So you know you need to get basically. Get something called a microtome or some other precise piece of kit that will be able to slice your material to really thin so that you can actually see through it. Now, the last set, which is the one I'm gonna, I understand better, is which doesn't mean that I understand them completely, but is a range of equipment called scanning probe microscopes. Now, scanning probe microscopes are a different way of approaching seeing things at a very small scale. So instead of actually trying to use light or electrons, what you do is you just, as a colleague has said, he said, "Oh, well, today I've been poking things with a stick." So that's basically what you do. You have this very very fine stick, and you poke the surface. And this this probe can be, you know, incredibly small, about 100 nanometers maybe. Maybe even smaller, maybe larger, but depending on how large the probe is, you know, you'll be able to see smaller or bigger features. Now, there's several ways of using this probe. The way it started scanning probe microscopy was with something called scanning tunneling microscopy. And there's a guy he's a Nobel laureate now, I think, for inventing this method. What this basically is that you take a tungsten wire. So tungsten is, you know, in the old light bulbs you have tungsten there, and tungsten is a very brittle material, very brittle metal, and you can basically, if you cut it, you can, since it's brittle, you can kind of ensure that that it's going to be very, very sharp. So you take that material and you go into a vacuum chamber. You take something that is electrically conductive, say you know, a piece of pure silicon, for example, or graphite, and you put a voltage bias to it. So you put you put your sample at 1 volt, and then you approach the probe. This very probe, very close to the surface, but without touching. And what you measure is the current that suddenly jumps through from the sample to your tip, or the other way around, I'm not sure, depending what side is grounded. This current is very small, it's nanoamps, and it's considered a nano and picoamps, and it's called a tunneling current, and that goes into the tunneling effect that you can go into quantum mechanics about it. But basically what it is that if the gap is small enough, electrons suddenly jump from one place to another. That's as far as I understand it. And so you measure this current, and you can imagine if you get slightly farther away, that current is going to be reduced, because, you know, the electrons can't jump that far. And if you get closer to the sample, then the electrons will flow more, so you will get more current. So the idea is that you say, okay, I want to be a certain distance away, so I'll say, you know, 1 nanoamp, and you tell the machine to scan, to move the probe, ensuring that the distance is always the same. And by doing that, you're saying that the current is going to be a certain fixed value in nanoamps. So this distance doesn't change, but for example, if you have a material, at some point you might have something that has a different material. So different materials conduct electricity in a different way. So your probe might get closer or might be farther away. So with this technique, you know, there's clever ways to get around it. So you'll be able to find out what one material is and what the other material is not. The problem with STM, scanning tunneling microscopy, which is what I've been rambling on for a bit, is that the sample needs to be conductive. So in comes another technique called atomic force microscopy. Now within atomic force microscopy, there's a lot of different all the other microscope methods also have a lot of sub methods. But this atomic force microscopy is really interesting, because you can find out more things apart from the shape of the surface. You can find out if something is magnetic. You can find out if something is more conductive or less conductive by using these different modes. So just to backtrack, a quick explanation that I like to make about atomic force microscope is, imagine you're in the nanoscale, so you are effectively blind. You can't see. So what do blind people do? They use several tools, but one of the tools that, you know, that I classically see in the street is a stick. So as you're walking, you can poke things around, and you find out that, you know, there's a step there, and there's a certain height. You know that there's a wall, and you can see where there's a sign or a lamppost, so you can avoid it. So, you know, you can basically feel your way around the surface. Now, let's imagine that you are the same person, and instead of a walking stick, you will be using a metal detector. You know, one of those metal detectors that you see people using it for scavenger hunts and to find coins in the beach or whatever. So this. This blind person will have this metal detector, and you know it's slightly bulkier, it's heavier, so you know he won't be able to find out smaller features as in size, but at least he or she now has more information regarding the conductivity of the materials. So I'm gonna pause there. So this blind person, you know, might not have, you know, cannot see the small holes in the sidewalk, but now we'll be able to know that there's a coin on the floor, or that there's one of these metal lids of a are they called manholes? Well, anyway, one of these holes in the street. So you know, he gets more information. So that's the advantage of using a probe. So now, going back to our nanoscale, the way this works, the way it was invented is a little more complicated to explain. But in short, it was you had this probe that didn't have to be conductive in any way to feel the surface, because it just had to let's say physically bend upwards as it was going up. And what they did was they put an STM, so the process before, you know, using the tunneling method, on the back of this probe. So it was actually feeling as the tip was bending upwards and downwards by measuring that nano amp current coming through it. But it was actually being the probe below it was able to see smaller things. So let me just start by describing the probe, which will put things in place. So the probes used in these nanoscale, you know, you buy them off the shelf. They can be anything between, I don't know, maybe 10 to 20, 15 euro each, to about 500 euro each for the more complex ones. So the 500 euro ones are actually that I've seen are scanning thermal microscopy tubes that actually are basically little thermometers going over the surface. So, but anyway, then let's go to the basic one. So the basic one is basically silicon. It's made out of you know, the stuff that sand is made out of without the oxygen, and they you know, like silicon chips, you know, that your processors are made. So there's a good industry behind it. So you can buy a box of 10 of these chips. So these chips contain a cantilever. I sometimes use cantilever, and I thought most people know it in English. So it's basically, if you imagine a trampoline, so you know, something that's held only from one side but not held on the other side. So that's what a trampoline is. So it's, if you imagine, that's what a cantilever is, a trampoline. Of course, you know, you probably do know what it is. So this cantilever is, if you imagine your trampoline, and it has a certain width. The width of the trampoline in the cases I've seen can be 50 microns thick, wide. Sorry, and it can be 1 or 2 microns thick. And then the length of it can be maybe 100 microns in length. So you know, 100 microns. I say as if it's very long, but that's, as I said before, that's about the thickness of a human hair. So this and then at the end of it, say you know, if you imagine you're on the trampoline, at the end of it, on the bottom, there's this kind of like cone-shaped feature coming out of the end, and that is what's called the tip. Now the tip is, it can be a cone. Well, normally, since it's silicon, it has to, the way it's fabricated, it breaks through the crystal structure, which I believe has a 70 degree tilt. Well, anyway, it breaks through the crystal structure, and it can be quite sharp. So at the tip end, it can be maybe less 50 nanometers in the rate in the tip radius at the end. But the shape of it in general is kind of like a pyramid, and it can come off the edge of the of let's say the cantilever. It comes down to maybe 2 microns, and some of them, you know, depending on how deep features you want to find out, they can be tens of microns in length. So remember, we can go over the units, but you know, go to the beginning of the cast and find out what microns and nanometers are. But hopefully, you're in the loop. Anyway, so the what we have is a chip that holds the cantilever, and the cantilever has a tip at the end. So it's you know, you can probably do a web search for AFM tips or AFM cantilevers or AFM chips, and there you would get scanning electron microscope images. Remember those black and white images I talked about before, that show you the you know, more or less the size of it, so you get an idea of how small these things are. So the way now how it doesn't really help you to know that you know, you're scanning this, you're moving this probe across the surface line by line, you know, just from left to right, as if you were lawn, you know, using a lawnmower over your backyard or your lawn or whatever. So it goes back, forwards, and then it did that line, and then it moves down one line and goes across another time and back and forwards. Now the probe is flexing up and downwards, and by flexing up and downwards, you know, the height of the features. Now these, how do you know that that really small thing is actually moving up and down? So at the beginning, as I said, they used an STM probe on the back of it, so they can measure the current going out up and down from it, but that quite limited the range, so you couldn't really, maybe that was the limitation, I'm guessing that's the limitation, that you know, it could only see features that were few nanometers in size, and people wanted to see things that were in microns in size. So what came up was a method using shining a laser light on the back of the cantilever. So if you shine a laser light on the back of the cantilever, and that reflects into a photodetector, which is basically a solar cell, let's say, and that photodetector has two parts, a part on the top and a part on the bottom. So normally the laser spot will be slightly in the middle, so the voltage that you get from the top minus the voltage that you get from the part on the bottom would be zero. Now if the laser spot shining on the cantilever, if the cantilever bends upwards, then the laser spot will move upwards on the photodetector. Hence you will have the top part will be larger than the bottom part, so you'll have a positive voltage. If the cantilever finds a hole, it will bend downwards, so you will have more voltage going into the B side, and the voltage will be negative. Hence, you know, you can then feed that voltage back into the instrument and request and ask the tip to move up and down. Now, how do you move? Well, this is getting really in depth. So, how do you move something up and down by several nanometers? So for that you use a material called piezoelectric material. Now piezoelectric materials are really interesting because you can put a voltage into it, and they actually either DC voltage, and they actually either shrink or grow depending on the signal of the sign of the voltage, and they you know, you can calibrate them to make sure that they grow by a certain amount. So. These piezo materials, maybe I'll go into it in a different podcast if people want. But anyway, so you have like this basically little material that acts like a motor, moving the thing up and down. And actually, there's another one using it to move left and right. Now, so you're scanning along, and you know, that thing goes up and down, and the detector tells you where it is on height. And then what you get is this map of let's say 1512 pixels by 512 pixels of values in Z, and with that you put it into a software analysis program. I personally like Gwydion, and I would highly recommend it. I've used several other data analysis programs for this atomic force microscopy, and this one is the best, and it's free software, as in free as in freedom, GPL licensed. And the reason I like it, if you listen to my previous podcast, is that it is maintained by the Czech National Measurement Institute, the CMI, and it can open almost all, if not all, file formats that all the different makes and models of atomic force microscopes do. So I've used 5 different types of atomic force microscopes from 5 different companies, and those 5 different companies have their, for some reason, decide to do their own data analysis software. And of course, each data analysis software then only opens their type of file format and doesn't open the other, you know, this again, open document formats. You know, this is where Free Software Foundation Europe and Free Software Foundation quite insist on having open formats. But anyway, let's not deviate. And Gwydion opens all of them. So it is a great piece of software. It is scriptable as well, which is great when you are recording a lot of data. And I highly recommend it if you want to get into atomic force microscopy. There are instructions, even papers and stuff that you can download and get instructions on how to build your own atomic force microscope. I would recommend doing, you know, maybe there's one about Lego that's really interesting. So I think that's about it. Hopefully I haven't rambled on for too long, and I can, you know, depending on how I feel like, I'll try to get more podcasts and things. So I used Audacity here. It was highly complicated. The previous podcast, I'm not sure how I did, but this one I just decided to record everything in one track. I don't know how it's gonna come out. And hopefully this will be saved, because I've been going on for about 25 minutes. If it's all lost, I'll be really upset. But anyway, thank you very much, and see you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.